Alessi, I'm Meghnad Desai. I used to work here, and I'm now a retired sort of supernumerary professor. It's a great pleasure for me to be here at the launch of Global Civil Society 2003. This is the third of the publications in the Global Civil Society series, which Mary Caldor, who is now the director of the Center for the Study of Global Governance, has been editing, along with the superb contribution of Marius Glacius. I'm also greatly delighted because Baroness Amos, Valerie Amos, has agreed to come and help us launch the Global Civil Society. Coming to sort of LSE is sort of a hazardous thing for anybody to do, and Valerie Amos suffered because she suddenly got promoted when she agreed to come to LSE. When I saw her yesterday, she was still in charge of DFID, and in 2 hours later, she's the leader in the House of Lords. So, there she is. The way she's been promoted from position to position, there's nothing left her but to be Prime Minister next. And I think we don't know what we'll do if that happens. But it's really a great delight because she has a tremendous wide experience in local authority, in equal opportunities, as well as in Parliament. So she's very much a person who knows about civil society in various ways, both locally and globally, and I'm very much looking forward to her contribution. Valerie Amos.
Thank you very much. When I had agreed to do this, I had agreed to do it as Secretary of State for International Development. And the fact that I changed jobs within the space of an hour yesterday after my conversation with Meghnad does not mean that I still don't continue to believe passionately in development issues. So I was very pleased to be able to come this evening, although I do have to apologize because I will not be able to stay. I will continue to speak on development issues in the House of Lords, so I guess there's a kind of background way in which I will be able to continue to stay engaged. And I was very pleased to be asked to launch this year's Civil Society Yearbook, and particularly in this year, which I think has been a very challenging year for us internationally. And in looking at the yearbook, I think what it challenges us as readers to do, and I received a copy not in its glossy form, but in a photocopied form, but what it does challenge us to do, I think, is to consider the major global issues which are confronting us as a society. And what I'd like to do in my opening remarks is to focus on what I see as the global role of NGOs. There's no doubt that the world of NGOs has changed enormously in the last 30 years. There are now 20,000 transnational NGOs, 90% of which were formed over the last three decades. And the arrival of the internet and the World Wide Web has allowed global coalitions of NGOs to make an extraordinary impact on the international scene. They've also earned themselves a place, I think, at the very heart of multilateralism. The Ottawa Convention on Landmines would never have been enacted without the active involvement of civil society in the process. The Jubilee campaign was instrumental in putting third world debt on the map. And with the new voluntary partnerships that emerged from last year's World Summit on Sustainable Development, NGOs now have a formal place in multilateral delivery frameworks. But there's a sense in which this is only the beginning. Because, of course, NGOs and charities have for a long time been involved in humanitarian relief, in campaigning on single issues from clean air to human rights, and in fundraising for worthwhile causes. But with the arrival of globalization, the world of civil society is changing every bit as fast as the global economy. And I'd like to take a moment just to think about two trends that strike me as being particularly significant. The first is that if you look at international politics and if you look at the kinds of international coalitions which are being created, then single issues are becoming more and more difficult to find. The reality of global interdependence blurs the boundaries between issues that were once perceived as separate from one another or as questions of straightforward cause and effect. We know, for example, that poverty can create conditions ripe for conflict. But we also know from very, very painful experience that the converse is also true. Conflict causes poverty. And conflict is in turn bound up with migration. Many of the asylum seekers, for example, who come to the United Kingdom are from countries where war is a current or a recent reality. And there is no shortage of other cross-cutting issues, from environmental degradation to HIV infection, from governance systems to terrorism. Positive trends in one sphere will reinforce positive trends in another, but negative trends will also reinforce negative trends in another sphere. So I think the real choice is not between, for example, environment and development, left and right, or any of the other false dichotomies that abound in politics. It's between vicious circles or virtuous spirals. As a result, civil society organizations are increasingly finding that they have to take more of a full system approach. And this raises challenges for being able to retain clarity of objective and focused branding. I very much welcome this trend towards a more integrated perspective and away from neat single issues that can create, I think, false dichotomies between civil society organizations. The sheer interconnectedness of the global challenges we face means that the response must be equally integrated. For the alternative is the potentially highly damaging situation of civil society groups in different sectors working at cross purposes instead of finding a new synthesis of their interests. I'll give you an example. At last year's World Summit on Sustainable Development, development NGOs argued very, very forcefully, and absolutely rightly in my view, that low-income countries must win better market access for their exports, particularly in the agriculture sector. And this has been a key theme of the negotiations we've been trying to get through in Cancun. Yet at that very same summit, environmental NGOs were arguing equally forcefully that the climate change impacts of transporting ever greater amounts of traded goods around the globe means that production should be localized and food miles reduced. Why, they asked, should butter be imported from New Zealand when we have a dairy industry here in the UK? I believe that these two positions need not be at odds with one another. Of course, least developed countries must be allowed to export their goods on fair terms. We all know that the only way that we're going to get real development in developing countries is if they have access to investment and if they have access to markets. And if we get rid of the subsidies that we use in the developed world to actually stop developing countries from exporting their products. But of course, we must also address global climate change by reducing global emissions. But above all, what we need to do is forge a political synthesis that takes account of both issues. By ensuring that climate change policy doesn't undermine developing countries and that developing countries have an equitable entitlement to emit carbon dioxide. So civil society groups have a vital role to play in what I call synthesis politics, a politics that takes a full system approach, denies single issues, and that applies seamlessly at every level, from the global to the personal. I think that this will entail being more radical, more imaginative, more lateral in our thinking. And it will especially mean that NGO partnerships happen not just within sectors, such as the excellent work of the trade justice movement, but also between them. It must become commonplace to see Greenpeace campaigning with Transparency International, Amnesty International with Oxfam, or the Refugee Council with church groups. And I'm delighted that we can already see evidence of this trend in so much of the campaigning that we're seeing today. And this leads me to the second issue that I'd like to mention, and that's the equally welcome trend of civil society groups to focus on solutions and ultimately on a vision of what we would all like to see in terms of our future society. The anti-globalization movement began as a coalition that defined itself entirely in terms of what it was against. This extraordinary diverse grouping of trade unions, small and family farmers, environmentalists, faith organizations, development NGOs, anarchists, and two others to list, often seemed able to agree on only one thing, that global capitalism was the source of all evil. But it was very hard to know what the movement was in favor of. And perhaps the reason for this was that in the end, what the anti-globalization movement was implicitly in favor of was diversity. It was founded on a concern that economic globalization was leading to a dystopian homogeneity, a world in which local cultures would be flattened by the juggernaut of the global economy, and in which all national regulations would end up at the same low level in a race to the bottom in regulatory standards. And the movement's passionate belief in diversity seemed often to extend to its own advocacy messages. Northern trade unions wanted protection from competition, even as development NGOs demanded an end to tariff barriers. And I saw this myself last week in Bournemouth at Labour Party conference, when I was addressing an Oxfam fringe meeting, and at the same time I had trade union colleagues who were arguing the complete opposite in terms of trade and protectionism that we were arguing in that fringe meeting. We had environmental NGOs who plead for environmental standards within the WTO, even as developing countries oppose such a move for fear that it would impede their competitiveness. But I believe that diversity as it is at its strongest when it's embedded within a context of unity. Unity and diversity need not be at odds. I'm going to do something slightly controversial and quote the motto of the United States of America. And in translation, it means, out of the many, one. Speaking as a member of the Labour Party, I think naturally of the words on the back of my Labour Party membership card. By the strength of our common endeavours, we achieve more than we achieve alone. But that does not make the Labour movement any less diverse. And I'm sure that any of you who were watching what happened in Bournemouth last week would recognise that. And that is why it's so welcome that the anti-globalisation movement has become a global justice movement. Of course, civil society groups will continue to protest against injustices, oppression, environmental degradation, and so on. And it's absolutely right that they should. But the movement can become much more powerful by setting out a vision of what it would seek to build at the global level. And in thinking about what you seek to build, you have to deal with some very, very difficult and tricky global challenges that face us right now. And in particular, I think, we have to deal with issues related to fundamentalism. And I was pleased to see that in the yearbook, this issue is being addressed. George Monbiot's recent book, The Age of Consent, I think is a fascinating evidence of this trend, although I know that Megnaed wrote a not too flattering review of this book about 4 weeks ago. In the book he writes, and I quote, "The movement's defining debate is just beginning. Led by activists in the poor nations, most of its members have come to see that opposition to the existing world order is insufficient. The quest for global solutions is difficult and divisive. Some members of this movement are deeply suspicious of all institutional power at the global level, fearing that it could never be held to account by the world's people. Others are concerned that a single set of universal prescriptions would threaten the diversity of dissent." And he sets out three proposals for a world parliament, an international clearing union for international financial reform, and a fair trade organization. Of course, these specific proposals are open to debate. But crucially, he asks of his readers that, and again I quote, "You do not reject these proposals until you have better ones with which to replace them." If the global civil society movement can achieve unity in its proposals for a just and sustainable future, whilst at the same time retaining its tremendous diversity of membership, then it will have achieved something extraordinary in the field of synthesis politics. And it will have created for itself a compelling political platform with powerful potential for getting results. From my perspective, no longer as Secretary of State for International Development, but as someone who will continue to speak on development issues, such a development would be very welcome indeed. I think we need to find new ways of working with civil society and to move towards a joined-up vision of what we are seeking to achieve in the field of global politics. And we need to move quickly, because the sheer danger posed by accelerating trends such as HIV infection rates, greenhouse gas concentration, desertification, topsoil loss, all of this means that we can't afford to delay. But in order to motivate our citizens, all of us, an area where civil society groups and we as government have a deep commonality of interest, we must move beyond the rhetoric of disasters to avert and engage instead in a serious, sustained conversation about the world that we are seeking to build. Thank you.
Well, I must thank Valerie Amos for coming here and giving that splendid send-off to the book, and I thank her again for a very thought-provoking speech. Thank you very much. Now, while she makes her escape, I'm going to divert your attention by chairing this panel. Okay, thank you all very much. We have three speakers on the panel. Marlies Glacius, who is at the Center for Civil Society, LSE, and who is one of the co-editors of the Global Civil Society 2003. Victoria Britton, who is not at The Guardian. Mm-hmm. She's at last escaped. And she's also at LSE, at the Development Studies Institute. And Professor Leslie Sclair, who is a professor of sociology, and has been writing on globalization for quite a long time before almost anybody else started writing. He was writing about corporations and the global nature of corporations. And we have disagreed for many years. Now, I think we're going to start with Marlies. I mean, you're going next, and then Victoria, and then Leslie. Okay. Alice.
Okay, what I'm going to be doing in the next 10 minutes or so is just sharing with you some of our findings in the book and basically plugging the book. I do also have personal opinions, and I'd be happy to share those with you later on in the debate. As for the book, as you may have realized, it's not actually for sale yet, but there is even better news because it is available for free on the internet. This is on the website of the Center for the Study of Global Governance, and it will soon have a link with the Center for Civil Society as well. To begin with the front cover, I'm not going to go through every page of it, don't worry. The front cover, as you can all see, is 90% snow, which is perhaps a slightly peculiar image for global civil society. But when I saw this photograph on the internet, I felt that this really captured global civil society. In our last 2 yearbooks, we had the collages of a whole number of photographs, but this one image, I thought, that is it. What it is an anti-war in Iraq demonstration in Antarctica, held last January. And having found this photograph on the internet, I got in touch with people in Antarctica who had been part of the demonstration, and they explained that they were from a whole number of countries, quite a few from the United States, and they felt it was very important to have this demonstration on February the 15th, along with everyone else. And the photographer was very pleased that we wanted it as a front cover and gave it to us for free, which is kind of a global civil society act in itself. Now, of course, the anti-war demonstrations were the most eye-catching kind of feature of global civil society in the year 2003, and it makes very explicit the point that we're always trying to make, that global civil society is more than NGOs, because this was all about demonstrations. In our opening chapter, we devote quite a bit of attention to those anti-war demonstrations, to the actual movement, and we show how they related and to some extent came out of the earlier anti-capitalist movement, who kind of saw the war and kind of Bush administration policy as the more urgent threat. And we also show that there was a relation with the social forums that began springing up all over the world, beginning with the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre. But the very important development in the last year has been the development of local social forums, and this is beginning to happen in Britain as well. We had the London Social Forum in this exact spot last Saturday. What you also saw in this anti-war mobilization was how Muslim groups and migrants more generally came together with the kind of all the peace movement, with the anti-capitalists, and also with very ordinary citizens. But at the end of the day, it did fail to prevent the war in Iraq. And I kind of thought to some extent that was the end of it. We speculate a little in the first chapter about the future of the anti-war movement. What I realized, we were in Cairo a few weeks ago for a seminar discussing the Arabic version of the Global Civil Society yearbook. And what I realized there was how important these demonstrations had been to the people in the Middle East. They were very appreciated. They had all sorts of speculations and were very curious and interested in exactly why so many people had gone on demonstrating. And we found that because of these demonstrations, we could have a much more open debate. We didn't necessarily agree with them on everything, but there was much less suspicion and much more kind of a shared view of some of the problems in the world and much more inclination to sustain a dialogue. So I think that may have been one of the effects of the anti-war mobilization. Didn't stop the war, but it may have opened a dialogue with this very important region. One of the slogans of that movement was "Not in my name," and that kind of leads quite nicely into one of the other big themes of this Global Civil Society yearbook, which is to really make the point that there is a difference between a government, a state, and its citizens. This is perfectly obvious, of course, but in traditional ways of studying social science, we still kind of think of every country as a little building block, and all together they kind of form international relations, international politics. How often do we in our own conversation say "the Americans," when in fact we mean the Bush administration? Now, our second and third chapter are very much along this theme of what we call methodological nationalism, not nationalism in the terms of being kind of passionately in favor of your nation, but simply not being able to kind of think beyond state-nation thinking. And the first chapter by Martin Shaw, I think, is a bit more optimistic. It describes a transformation in the social sciences as it is already happening. And I think ILSE is a very interesting and important place where that may be happening to some extent. Ulrich Beck writes a chapter explaining how this methodological nationalism isn't just kind of a blindfold, but is actually morally problematic, because we may see social inequalities in our own society and consider that part of our responsibility, but global social inequality we just do not see as our shared responsibility in the same way. And I think certain parts of global civil society, again, are kind of trying to break through that idea that what happens outside your borders is not your responsibility. Another big theme is, once again, globalization, a debate on globalization. And what we find looking at actors in global civil society is that thinking about pro versus anti-globalization is really rather outdated. Those positions still exist, pure supporters of globalization of all kinds, and Meghna Desai is usually mentioned as the one example,
the only example.
Of someone who really personifies this, because a lot of economic globalizers are very restrictive when it comes to globalization of people, of migration. Pure rejectors, real isolationists, again, are rather hard to find. You'd probably have to go to North Korea. So we find the vast majority of people into other positions. One, we're not the first ones to point this out. The so-called anti-globalization movements are more reformers of globalization. They want to change it. The beautiful French word for it is altermondialiste. They want to alter the direction of globalization. They want globalization if it benefits the poor and marginalized. They tend to support it more when it comes to globalization of the rule of law and of people, and they're more mixed, and as the Baroness Amos also referred to, they disagree on globalization of the economy and technology. What we are quite possibly the first to point out very clearly is the fourth position on globalization that we see emerging, which we call regressive globalization or regressive globalizers. And I'll first give you a whole enumeration of all sorts of people who might fit that category and then some idea of what that category entails. And we're thinking of anti-immigrant parties and sentiments in Europe and in Australia, Hindu nationalism in India, settlers in the occupied territories, Islamic fundamentalists, the Christian right in the US, but also in all the industries and perhaps even some trade unions there. And the way we see regressive globalization, what it is for us, is globalization if and insofar as it benefits us, our group. It's very much about group thinking, and exclusion is as important to that as inclusion. These groups, to a large extent, all use technology, the internet, and the diaspora to mobilize. Sometimes they are neoliberal, sometimes they are protectionist in their economic policies. They generally tend to be opposed to globalization of the rule of law, globalization of people, but the guiding principle is globalization if it benefits us. And in Chapter 4 in Trade, co-authored by our chair, Meghna Desai, this idea of these four positions is again taken up, and it describes how, on the one hand, the anti-capitalist movement has really moved on and grown up since that moment in Seattle when it was all protest. It's had some victories, but it's also getting increasingly disillusioned with the idea of making trade work for the poor. And it may be moving more from a reformist to a rejectionist, protectionist position. According to the authors, one of us here, dismantling the World Trade Organization is a real possibility. It's really quite possible that activists, along with certain states, are able to do that. And they think it would actually be a disaster. The next chapter, Chapter 5, very different. It describes a very small set of global civil society actors who are not really a movement and hardly go noticed, but they urgently need to become one, because these are the civil society actors who work to prohibit and continue to fight the proliferation of biological and chemical weapons. We're going to have a debate with some of these people here in a month's time to flesh out some more what global civil society activism against this proliferation might consist of. The next chapter, on the other hand, is a tremendous success story, I think, which is the movement against violence against women. And it shows the importance of framing an issue in a certain way that captures the imagination and that brings diverse actors together. And what violence against women managed to do was bring domestic violence, traditional community violence, human rights violations by the state, war crimes against women together as one big movement, saying it's all violence against women, it's all wrong, and we can fight it all in the same way. There are fissures in that movement as well, however, and especially the sex trade has become a real really difficult issue for this movement to deal with. Then the next chapter, quite possibly, is one of the most controversial. This is a chapter on religious and nationalist militant groups. And the question here really is, does that even fit in a book that calls itself Global Civil Society? Well, we decided that we had to at least deal with groups that you could call actually existing civil society that have a lot of characteristics in common with kind of good civil society in this book, and that we had to discuss both what they are like and whether one might consider them civil society. And what this book, what this chapter does is really flesh out the this idea of what these regressives are. And it gives some analysis, lots of factual detail on their ideology, methods, forms of organizing, communicating, and funding, having a look at what they all have in common, and also to some extent having in common with other global civil society groups. They tend to be horizontal networks that rely to a large extent on shared values rather than an old-fashioned hierarchical structure. The next chapter, chapter 8, I'm rather fond of. It's a very optimistic chapter again about transnational peasants movements and network, because you do kind of tend to think of civil society mainly as an urban middle class phenomenon, but this shows that some of the most marginalized people are becoming politically empowered and are beginning to network transnationally. It also shows that peasants are traditionally thought of perhaps as very parochial and suspicious of strangers, that even in this movement there's increasing solidarity and recognition of common problems between north and south, between south and south, and so on. And so even peasants are becoming cosmopolitans. There's also a connection there with a trade chapter, because the mobilization against the free trade agreement of the Americas came very largely from this transnational peasant movement. Then the last chapter is about the legal environment for civil society, mainly at the national level. It also says something about the global level, because at the end of the day, global civil society cannot survive in a repressive environment. It also needs some rules, though. It cannot survive in a lawless environment either. And this chapter tries to develop some ideal types of what ideal legislation for civil society might look like and give some good examples of best practice, worst practice, and also how civil society itself is actually working towards better legislation. Those are the actual chapters. Then the last one quarter or so of the book is what we call records of civil society, where we really try to collect lots of very substantive data to get at this kind of very slippery phenomenon of global civil society. We have a chapter with lots of maps in it. We're using a new technique, geographic information systems, to kind of map what we know about global civil society. And out of that came something very interesting that we did not know and do not quite understand. We'll have to develop it further. What we said in our first Global Civil Society yearbook was that there seemed to be a correlation between economic globalization, respect for the rule of law, for human rights, for international law generally, and a high density of non-governmental organizations, not necessarily civil society, but NGOs. What we found now when we actually started mapping this is that there's a clear correlation at the top end. Some countries have lots of all three of these, and there's a clear correlation at the bottom end. But in between, there's not much correlation at all, and we have to work out much better what's actually going on there. In our data section, we have far more maps than we used to have, and that's a new way of representing things. Something else that's new that we have is we make much more use of surveys. There turn out to be lots of different types of surveys in which people are asked about different aspects of globalization. This can be the general public, activists, also global elites and business elites. And it's very interesting to put all these surveys together. to get a feel for what people think of globalization. Then finally, we always have a chronology of global civil society events, and that's really one of the most collaborative parts of the Global Civil Society Yearbook. We now have almost 100 correspondents in different countries who send us bits of information about what's happening in their country, and that's something to get away from our pure NGO-based numbers data, which we feel is rather Western biased and doesn't tell us everything about what's going on the ground. Also, we have updates, little updates on the chapters we had the last 2 years. I think we'll have to stop doing that at some point because the book is getting thicker and thicker. But that's a whole description of what you can find in Global Civil Society 2003.
Thank you very much. Well, there used to be a Cold War. This is called anti-war. All I can say on the front. Now, Victoria Britain has been trying over many, many years to civilize the readers of The Guardian with knowledge about the third world. It's kind of a Pyrrhic effort, I find. But all power to her elbow. But now she has come to LSE, and I'm sure she will civilize us. Victoria Britain.
Thank you, Midmad. Very nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me. My first reaction is to really very, very warmly welcome this book. And I congratulate the authors and the editors on its incredibly wide range and the depth into which they've gone into both some of the theoretical and the practical lines that Marlies outlined. What may not be so clear to the students here is what an astonishing achievement it is to have brought the marginal, which is what civil society has been, so well and truly into the mainstream of both political and academic discourse. It would have been completely unthinkable just a very few years ago either to have had a book like this or to have had a British government minister talking about civil society. And I think it is a tremendous testimony to the people who worked in this, on this, and in this area over the last few years that they've actually managed to do that. It's a huge achievement. And of course, it's not that there wasn't civil society before. There was, but it was not recognized, and it was not, crucially, it was not organized with the kind of international links to do with the internet and so on that others have already mentioned. And in fact, the figure of the civil society organizations have quadrupled in 20 years is a kind of fairly astonishing one. The thing I want to look at most closely, although I haven't got very long, so I shan't be looking at it that closely, is Perna Sen's incredibly important chapter 6 on the global movement to end violence against women. And I also want to make some points broadly in agreement with most of the main findings of the authors. But I want to say two different things that come to my mind reading this. One is about the methodology behind the kind of research that lies in this book. And another is about the kind of choices made. And both these things come up very much in my own work. And they must have faced many of the authors here, although they skate rather lightly over them. But I just want to discuss them a little bit. And for this purpose, I'm actually only relating to two specific areas where I work. One is the occupied Palestinian territories, specifically Gaza, and the other is the Democratic Republic of Congo, specifically the East. What links these two is an incredibly high level of violence that's taken place and is taking place over a very long period. And the weak, or indeed virtually absent, government in both cases. And in contrast, the very surprisingly very, very vibrant civil society. But that's not what I'm not going to talk, that's not what I'm going to talk about in detail. I want to say two things. First of all, on methodology. Whenever I give a talk or I write an article in The Guardian, I always get lots of emails from PhD students saying, can I come and talk to you about the methods you use in your interviews? And the first thing I always say, and they look really disappointed, is when I say, well, you know, they aren't scientific. The kind of surveys that Marlies is talking about are simply not applicable in the kind of work, in the kind of societies that I work in. And I try to explain, for instance, what it's like to interview genocide suspects in a prison in Rwanda. And I say, you know, you're in a very, very crowded room in which everybody can hear what you're asking and what the other person is saying. You're talking to people largely illiterate. You're talking to people whose second language, French, they often don't even, they don't speak that, so you've got an interpreter. And they live in a society in which mass responses are how people react, and the whole history of the genocide is kind of to do with that. And like all peasant societies, any interviewing that you do, you have to absolutely leave at home short Western attention spans, because it takes a very long time. You have to be very, very patient. Or, for instance, to make the same point about Gaza, if you go and visit a block of flats which has just been flattened by an American F-16 fighter bomber, there will be lots of kids hanging around. They're all longing to, they're looking at what's left, and they're all longing to take you to their family and talk to their mum and so on and so forth, and you go there. But you're not going to whip out your notebook and say, here are a few questions I prepared when I was, you know, back at home for my PhD thesis. You just sit there and you kind of wait to see what happens. This is a very complicated kind of research, and it's not scientific. And there must be an awful lot of that underlying the kind of work that's in this book. So I just wanted to make that point about research, because I think people don't think about it enough. And the second is the point about choices. The choices that are made about which civil society organizations or which NGOs to support or to have relationships with can be absolutely crucial in deforming that particular NGO in the context of the kind of places that I'm talking about. And for instance, I recently did some work for DFID in DRC, in Congo. And the most sophisticated civil society organizations that I talked to all said, for heaven's sake, don't give us a lot of money, because £10,000 would be the end of us. The moment anybody knew about us, we would all be out of business. And you know, these are some of the kind of complexities that lie behind the kind of work that's gone on here. There's a particularly good discussion about a closely related subject, the complexity of who chooses women's movements leaders and who gives them legitimacy in that chapter 6 I referred to, Perna Sen. But as Marlies said, the great pleasure of this chapter is it's a celebration of a mind shift in the world. And it's a celebration of the continuing will to fight by women, and a celebration of how good they are at it. And the changes in attitudes that she brings out here, the challenge to myths about women and violence, which began in the 70s and of course grew out of the theoretical feminist work of the 1960s. To take a very key example, she traces the international links which have built up over the last decade or so, and which actually led the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice managing to bring gender concerns to the heart of the creation of the International Criminal Court. The people who were going to set that up certainly had not any such idea in mind, but they've got it now. And it was the same kind of coalition of women lawyers who brought the first definition of rape in international law to the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. She also traces the institutional gains and the conceptual shifts, many of them through the United Nations, things like the appointments of special rapporteurs for various human rights monitoring posts that have special reference for women. However, I'm a bit more cautious about the UN and what it does by these kind of appointments than she is. Rhetoric is a lot easier than action, but I won't go into that more. I just want to say, on as Marlies mentioned, this phrase, regressive globalization, and I think it's a very, very important strand running through this book and through our ideas about the future of these kind of things, because it is a threat. which could reverse the value shift in general civil society work for justice, not only for women, that's taken place recently. And I want to make another tiny point of caution. International NGOs are increasingly powerful, but let's not fall into the trap of thinking that that's always positive. Within international NGOs, there are some very, very negative trends. And one of the points that they make in the book is about the way that NGOs, international NGOs, are increasingly funded by foundations and corporate funds. Well, I'm sure this will ring a few warning bells everywhere. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And in a world where the dominant superpower is expressly opposed to much of the funding of mainstream women's health programs, for instance, and the government of that superpower is so intertwined with corporate interests, there are likely to be less and less of what I would call the body shop type initiatives, small initiatives for civil society in the third world, and more of the kind of initiatives which fund, for instance, religious interventions or ideologically based funding for universities. And these kind of trends will have very huge impacts in the future direction of the third world countries which are involved in them, and in the political trends which will then become dominant within those countries. And I'm sorry I haven't got time to say more, but I think I've had my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No, thank you very much. I'm going to be very disciplined and not start commenting on what you said, which is very interesting, but move on straight to Leslie Sclair, who, as I said, has written over many years about globalization. I'm sure he has some interesting comments. Leslie.
Thank you. Well, you don't want me to add to the congratulations about what an achievement this book is, but I will. ever since I started using it for teaching in my globalization course here, its value has become very clear. However, I have a few small critical points I'd like to make, which is the reason you bothered to invite me. Okay. I think there are two problems that really blunt the critical edge of this yearbook. In fact, there are three. I'll dispense with the first very quickly. I much appreciated Marlis's comments about the need to break out of the nation-state box. I mean, if this was a different time and a different place, I would want to argue that the future of the human race's survival on this planet really depends in the long term, the medium term, on us breaking out of the nation-state box. So although there's a lot of attempt to go transnational, as it were, in the text or some of the texts that I've read, I am disappointed that not more effort, and you're going to hate me for this, has been made in the tables, because it's I know how difficult it is to produce non-state centrist data. But if you've got a message in the text which says, we've got to break out of the nation-state box, we've got to be conscious of methodological nationalism and all the rest, and then you turn to all the tables and everything is in terms of nation-states, then people may get confused. So it seems to me that this is for your methodological and statistical unit, now you're becoming a major transnational corporation, that this should be a really high priority. I mean, for example, looking at issues of gender, it's not easy, but it's quite possible to produce comparative data on gender cross-nationally by the other great determinant of life chances. Nation state, the state you're born in is one, but of course class is the other. Now some of you may never have heard this term before, class, but for some of us who are frozen in the last century, right, it still has a function. Okay, my two main criticisms of the bits that I managed to read of the text. First of all, I think there's a critical failure to distinguish between what I'd like to call generic globalization and other forms of globalization. And there's a real confusion in the book about this, and it's not just this year, it was the previous year and the year before. Now, what I mean by generic globalization is something like globalization defined in terms of the electronic revolution, which is what really transformed the whole debate. I mean, you can argue that globalization started 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 years ago, but it's clear to anyone with eyes to see that it only really kicks in a global geopolitical sense when you've got the electronic revolution there to give you the tools through the mass media, through reconstituting production processes and the service industries and all the rest of it. Secondly, what the electronic revolution does is it helps to produce new forms of transnational social spaces that are not locked into particular places. And thirdly, it also produces new forms of cosmopolitanism. Now, this is a whole big argument, but this is what I mean by generic globalization. So what are the other forms of globalization? Now, clearly, the most important form of globalization is capitalist globalization. And it's interesting that the critical focus of the book depends on this, what to me is an extraordinarily naive concept of regressive globalization. You define regressive globalization as the globalization which is pursued by people who are only interested in their own interests. So I think, well, what happened to capitalism? What happened to what I call in my work the transnational capitalist class? Are they people who spend their days and nights worrying about me and you? No, these are people who spend their days and nights worrying about profits and the profits of their corporations. Now, why is that not regressive globalization, but some poor, misinformed, fanatical Muslim who wants to throw bombs? Okay, now that's a question. I'm not suggesting an answer to that. I'm just saying why. Okay.
It is.
It is. Good. We can discuss it. And you can tell me why. That's the point, to raise questions, even from Mary. Right. So, capitalist globalization is one form of globalization, distinguished from generic globalization. And there are also other possible forms. And these are forms which I think maybe we should be thinking about as well. Rather than doing what pretty well everybody does nowadays and saying, okay, we're stuck with capitalist globalization, let's try and give it a more human face. Let's try and make it better. Now, I'd like to suggest that I'm not alone in suggesting that there are other alternatives and that it's not good enough after 200, 300, 400, 500 years to say, well, let's give capitalist globalization another chance, more chances. Now, this might sound horribly utopian to most of you. I'm talking in the medium to long term here. And it's interesting that where capitalist globalization does get a bit of a run in this book, in the article by Said and Desai, they seem to equate capitalism with trade, or at least as the target of the anti-capitalist movement. Now, it's quite true that there's a lot of anti-capitalist activity and thinking and theorizing about trade, but this is the oldest trick in the book, to deflect the argument onto trade and to take it away from the roots of capitalism, the base of capitalism, which is the process of production, which is, of course, something which lots of people in global civil society organizations are interested in, but this has become flooded by the anti-trade debate. And I just want to make one small comment again about this, which to back up what Victoria said, that another thing which is generally absent is any consciousness that global civil society can be, and certainly has been, penetrated very deeply by, again, what I've called the transnational capitalist class. And there's a struggle going on here. I mean, the point that many small organizations have the choice between taking money from people they don't want to take money from or going under is deeply expressive of the sort of society in which we live. So the whole concept of global civil society may indeed be flawed, because it does not yet have sufficient empirical and theoretical foundations to demonstrate that it escapes the power of, again, what I call the transnational capitalist class. Now, this is all very puzzling, because much of the momentum for global civil society comes precisely from the opponents of capitalism. And what I'm saying is not unique or original in any way. It's what many people in the movement are saying. But somehow it fails to get shown, illuminated, in what I'd call the institutional critique of global civil society, the sort of critical mass that you're trying to develop here. And this leads me on to my second criticism, and that is there seems to be very little discussion, perhaps not even any recognition, of the contradictions of what we can call capitalist globalization. And again, this is a function of the fatalism that I think this yearbook shares with the work of our lately departed, well, on this earth, but still departed from the LSE, beloved director, Tony Giddens, whose Runaway World, for example, is a sustained argument for the fact that, okay, we're stuck with capitalist globalization. Let's try and make it a bit better for people who are less fortunate than we are. Now, I don't think this is good enough. I think there are two central contradictions of capitalist globalization which the civil society, the global justice movement, on the ground tries to deal with, but is not sufficiently well represented in the book. Maybe it wasn't that sort of book you wanted to write. The first is class polarization. That is the phenomenon since the 1970s of the rich getting richer, a much more numerous group of very rich people all over the world. And again, let's not be state centrist about this. It happens in Tanzania, it happens in Nepal, and it happens in Bolivia. Not to the same extent as it happens in the US, but it still happens there. So the rich getting richer and a more numerous group, and the poor either getting poorer to some extent, certainly not getting any richer to the extent that they would be able to have 3 square meals a day, and the gap between the rich and the poor once again beginning to widen. The second contradiction in capitalist globalization is ecological unsustainability. And again, there's a lot of debate about that. But it's quite clear that a lot of the momentum for the global civil society movement comes precisely from people who believe that we're in an ecological crisis in the planet. And that this ecological crisis is not only connected with capitalist globalization and its rampaging culture, ideology, consumerism, but it's a direct consequence of it. So, why do I think that there are these problems in the book? Well, I think it's because there's a failure to engage with left politics. We heard the Baroness tell us that the left-right divide was no longer relevant, which indeed is the scripture and verse of New Labour, the Labour Party being a party I'm still proud to be a member of. Okay, well, many of us think the left-right divide is still pretty relevant. Now, an expression of this in the book, you haven't got it, so I'll have to show you the picture, are two pictures here. One of Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, waving his little blue book. And one is of Lula, waving his little finger. Now, okay, this I think is rather dismissive. These are rather dismissive references to two political leaders who both came to power on the crest of a truly phenomenal popular support in two countries that are well known for being the most divided and in many ways oligarchic in the whole world. Now, the little blue book, you're unlucky here, I just happen to have a copy of. Now, what is this little blue book? This little blue book is the constitution of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. I'm not an apologist for the Venezuelan government or Hugo Chavez. Far from it. But I'll just tell you, you buy this little blue book on the streets of the cities and towns of Venezuela. It's cheap. It's a mass media item. because people who have been governed by oligarchies in a truly dreadful society up till now, now have their own constitution. Now, whether Chavez is a genuine left politician or not is not the issue here. The issue is that we still live in an age of states, and when politicians come to power with the support of the workers and the peasants, and with the vicious opposition of the oligarchy, then people who are interested in global civil society should pay respect and not make small jokes. The same with Lula. Okay, the point is made. And with all due respect to Naomi Klein and the super brand of No Logo, Chavez and Lula, and this makes a reference to a quote that Meghnad made to Naomi Klein in the book, Chavez and Lula were elected by millions of workers and peasants to stand up against the transnational capitalist class and capitalist globalization and to begin to transform their societies. And that's the issue for global civil society, not just, in my view, to make capitalist globalization a little bit more user-friendly. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. We have about 20 minutes for questions, and after that there will be a reception in the Robinson Room. So I'm going to ask people, there are floating mics, and wait for the mic to come, and I will say what I always say: I want questions and I do not want statements. And if a thing doesn't begin by saying, does the panel agree that, I'll stop you. Okay? Now, questions. Only one question left. Yeah, gentleman there. And then the gentleman there. Anybody on the side? Oh, over here. He's going to ask a long question, I know. Yeah, go ahead. I can't hear you, it's not on. Just get up and shout.
Shout, yeah.
I'll repeat your question.
Go there, because people at the top won't be able to hear.
No, I'll repeat your question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you not agree that throughout the presentation, you have failed to distinguish the distinction between globalization as being the object in global civil society, and you failed to mention the object, namely,
okay, have we not failed to, or had the panel or somebody not failed to mention globalism rather than just globalization? Now who's going to answer that? I'm only chairing this. I'm not going to.
Well, I'll have a go.
Well, because my view is that there is only capitalism, there is no globalization. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm not at all sure what globalism is. In fact, exactly. I'll tell you, we initially called our first chapter, The State of Global Civil Society in an Era of Regressive Globalism. One of our team then said, what is globalism? What a strange word. I don't think it exists. We went to a dictionary and didn't find that it existed. So if you can make clear what globalism is, maybe you can explain why it's not
in
there.
Don't. I'm not having a debate. The gentleman here. You. Yeah. Keep it short. Yeah. Stand up and give it short.
Okay, you look the same despite being the emeritus professor as I am. I don't know why, how come you get...
No, question.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
The question is about the Tories conference. So much is talked about the Labour conference. Yeah. They issued that until otherwise the refugees settle, they will have to live in a faraway place. But rather than addressing this issue, why don't these Western nations are not willing to address the real cause of the roots of the refugee issues, I mean, the civil war.
Okay.
So for that, we need a strong United Nations. Without a strong United Nations, how can we have a civil society? What
could
be done to strengthen the United Nations?
Okay. Who wants to answer that? Victoria, you can't run the United Nations, don't you? Why don't you ask a question?
What can be done to strengthen the United Nations? Remove the Security Council?
Yeah, yeah.
would be the simple and obvious point. But in the real world, where that's not going to happen, I think you would have to see a Security Council which has no vetoes and which is much bigger. You need to have on it Brazil, India, South Africa, a group of different countries that will not be dominated by the United States. And the second point is, I think you have to look to, I think you need Germany as well, because you need to strengthen Europe so that Europe can be a counterweight to the United States. Until you have that, the UN will be what it is.
Good. Next question. Yeah, gentlemen here.
What does the panel think about the growing state-led gangsterism in the world, the corporate gangsterism in the world, crimes against humanity by the nation state? How is it going to foster a global civil society? Is there a global civil society?
Okay. After? What does the panel think about corporate, etc., gangsterism?
You were asking, what do we think about state-led terrorism?
Is state-led terrorism, corporate gangsterism?
After all this is happening, is there a global civil society? Is there a global?
Yeah. Well, I of course don't like it. And I don't think any of us like
what?
But more to the point is what can we do about it? And given where we are, you know, it's always important to start off from where you are. It's good to have dreams saying where you'd like to get to, but it's important to start off where we are. Well, we are in a mature democracy. And if we vote for Tony Blair to be Prime Minister collectively, then Tony Blair will be Prime Minister. If we vote in our local political parties for so-and-so to be selected as the candidate, that person will be selected as the candidate. So why I'm not totally pessimistic after all that I said, why I'm really extremely optimistic, is because I think democracy can be made to work. It's going to be a real struggle because of the way in which democracy actually does work. Anybody heard any results in California, for example, today?
What's democracy got to do with that?
Yeah.
Sorry, that's all right.
Quite right. Yeah. Keep us short.
I'm wondering if you could speak to the relationship between global corporate media and global civil society, and whether it's, I mean, the reflexive aspects of it or just.
Well, want to have something about that?
Yeah, I'll say something about it. We've had two chapters of media into previous editions of the yearbook, so this is a way to plug those as well. And, of course, it's a very difficult relationship. The internet is often seen as this free space where global civil society moves and has been seen as one of the conditions, one of the drivers of something called global civil society. I think to some extent it still is, but the big warning in that chapter was the corporations are ready to take over. It isn't there yet, but it is. I think, you know, it is going that way. And the interesting thing is that there are activists who are at the same time techies who continue to try and be one step ahead. As for the traditional media, I think the picture is much bleaker, and I'm sure Leslie would give a much better analysis of that, but that is a much tougher area for global civil society, which is why it's moved into this new media.
Well, typically the dialectic kicks in again, because not only has the electronic revolution produced the mass media that we know and loathe, it's also produced the mass media that those who are deeply involved in global civil society use every day. And I wouldn't be too despondent about that. Make the point about democracy again, and that is that nobody forces you to buy the gutter press. Nobody forces you to watch gutter television. So maybe the lesson there should be, this is a problem for the educational system in a democratic society. Again, it's going to take a long, long time, but these are the openings and we have to use them if we're serious about wanting to change things.
Use your remote. Yeah.
Is because you talked a lot about the positive aspects of the violence against women campaigns and how successful women have been at mobilizing internationally. I'd just like to say that if you look at the statistics for violence against women, it's not getting any less. Now, I mean, it seems to me that that very point you were making, that that we have to be very careful about talking about success.
Yeah, thank you.
And that, and those terms.
Yeah. How do you measure the success of global civil society movements, especially when you look at the violence against women? Anybody wants to respond to that?
I'd like to say something very short on this. Yeah. Just to relate to the question of women, I think the increased visibility of domestic violence, for instance, is an important new factor. That's one new thing. But the other thing is that in a very increasingly militarized international context, the violence against women is going to inevitably grow as part of that trend. So there are two things contradictorily going on. But as for other campaigns, I wouldn't.
Yeah. Let me just say this about statistics, that when I was doing something on human rights about 10 years ago, the one country where we found no human rights violations was Oman. Not because it was perfect, but because you're not allowed to register human rights violations. The fact that there are statistics of violation is kind of a mixed thing, especially when a trend is that before nobody was talking about violence against women, and now we are talking about violence, as well as the fact what Victoria said, that there are phenomena which are increasing violence against women.
Yeah, that's a point I would like to stress more generally, that I would never say measure success, because I think it suggests some sort of academic accuracy that you can't provide anyway. But I think what global civil society is really good at is putting things on the agenda and changing people's minds about things, really coming to a mind shift. As for actually changing facts, that's a whole lot more difficult. But I think the mind shift is a really good beginning. And it's that what we describe. I don't think measuring success. I think often global civil society, and even more so NGOs, when they're talking to their funders, are judged very much in the short term, where you should really have a long view, because, as Leslie said, these problems are so big that you should really think much more long term. And a mind change in mind shift is a very big thing.
The lady over there. Oh, the person over there, yeah.
I would like to ask Marlies Glacius to explain us a little more the concept of a regressive globalization. And I was asking myself, is it really, because the term implies that globalization in this area, as you mentioned, have gone some way, and now there's a backlash, 10 seconds. But is it really that there was advance in that area, or is it maybe rather that nothing has happened in terms of globalization? So maybe you can explain this concept a bit more.
Yes, I'd love to, because that also kind of is a way for me to give a little bit of a response to Leslie. By regressive, we don't mean so much going backwards as in turning the clock back. By regressive, we rather mean the wrong kind of globalization. Globalization in the very areas that you would not like to see it. As for Leslie's point about capitalist globalization being kind of the most nasty self-interested globalization there is, I think there is some truth in that, and to some extent capitalist globalizers for us are part of this regressive globalizer group. But what I would say in response to that criticism is, on the one hand, we think not all capitalist globalization is bad, but even more important, not only capitalist globalization is bad, there are other very important nasty things, and this is why the book is not called Anti-Capitalism 2003, it's called Global Civil Society 2003, because there's more going on. And while left-right distinctions may not have become irrelevant, we want to make the point in the book that the distinction between people with a communalist outlook and with a cosmopolitan outlook is at least as important now. And so that's what regressive globalization for us is. It's kind of a communalist us versus them use of globalizing.
Yeah, good. Yeah, okay. Yeah, but I've got to look upstairs as well, you know. Yeah.
Do the panel see any dangers of elitism in the advocacy politics of global civil society compared to the traditional democratic accountability politics?
Okay, elitism. Who wants to take elitism? Leslie.
Well, I don't think I'm the one to answer that question, but I agree with the questioner's implication.
I'm also going to answer, so yes, to you, the first part of your question. And I thought actually Leslie's point about class was very well taken. I think it's absolutely true that global civil society does tend to be rather middle class. Those are the people that go to the global level. And even if they have aspirations to help other classes, which I think they often do, this is who they are, and they're to some extent bound by it. What I do not agree with is the favorable comparison with how it used to be, as if party politics did not used to be led by elites.
I have to say the only successful revolutionary class is the middle class. Yeah. So far. Yes. Nobody else has made a revolution. Except the bourgeoisie. We're still waiting for the working class. Anyway.
You mentioned Hindu nationalism in India as an example of regressive globalization. And subsequently explained...
What's the question?
The question is, you explained regressive globalization as interested groups working for globalization. Can you kindly give one example of not regressive globalization?
Non-regressive globalization. I think the very obvious point that's already been made, the fact that that access to the internet is now far more widespread than it ever used to be, this obviously benefits people and to some extent benefits the poor. So there's non-regressive globalization. I'll throw in another example, which is the establishment of the International Criminal Court. It's not nearly as universal as I would like it to be, but it's going towards providing more global accountability and justice for human rights violators.
Yeah, lady over there, yeah.
Hi. One of the opening comments that Victoria made was on the tremendous progress. Can you hear me okay down there?
No.
No, not at all.
Shout.
Tremendous progress.
It's on?
Shout.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shout.
Okay. One of the opening comments that Victoria made was the tremendous progress that civil society has made over the past 30 years. But I was wondering if the book makes any reference to maybe perhaps kind of the negative consequences that we might see with so many kind of voices and NGOs, so many hands in the cookie jar, so many issues being raised by smaller NGOs that, yeah. You know, I know that was one of the big issues.
Okay, who wants to take that?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. Well, I think the question was that when you talked about successes, aren't there differences between large and small NGOs?
No,
the question was...
So what is the question? Repeat the question.
There are too many people trying to do the same thing.
Negative consequences for having all of these NGOs.
Okay. Aren't there too many of them? Okay, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Does the book address the fact that there are too many NGOs?
I don't think we say so much directly too many, as in maybe too many in specific places and too few in other areas. Yeah. Too many big Western-dominated ones who come in with their values, and they sometimes push out small grassroots groups and so on. So we don't say too many overall, but we do say, well, too many of some kind.
Yeah, you want to add something, yeah.
No, okay, let it go.
Well, there you are there, yeah.
Victoria Britton, you briefly mentioned about the leaders of the civil society. If there is a relatively clear idea of global civil society, but does that mean there is a concept of global leadership? If so, who are the leaders, and how do they get there?
Who are the leaders of the global civil society, and how do they get there?
Well, I think the point I was trying to make, which is also made in various places in the book, is that this is a very hit or miss area, and quite often the people who are acclaimed by the media as the leaders of civil society are actually nothing much to do with the grassroots. And I mean, I could give you a dozen examples of people who are extremely well known, but actually when you go to the place where they ostensibly come from, you find a completely different group who has nothing to do with them whatsoever. So it's a minefield.
Okay, someone in the very last row up there.
Yes, my question has to do with the yardsticks to measure progress and regress. Do you see a phenomena over the years that with weapons of mass deception and other things that we need to come up with counter benchmarks which can help us understand how far we are going? What I have understood that is manifestation of protest is being considered as a good measure. But is it sufficient enough?
Very good question. Mali.
As I said in answer to a previous question, I'm rather uncomfortable with yardsticks and benchmarks and statistics and data. I think we can provide some analysis to give some sort of sense of where global civil society is going. But I don't think even scientists that purport to be exact are actually that good at yardsticks and benchmarks. Oh, we wouldn't want to try that. As for specifically, you know, mobilization demonstrations, is it a good thing? I'm inclined to think that people participating in politics rather than turning away from it tends to be a good thing, but I may not like every specific demonstration, for instance, Hindu nationalist mobilizations. Specifically about the anti-war demonstrations, I already mentioned some of the unintended effects, how it seems to be opening up a dialogue with the Middle East.
Anybody else? No? Okay. Gentleman there, yeah.
Hello there. I was very interested.
This question.
The Arab, you were going to Middle East, and you fed up with Arabs who were talking about having a project like yours.
What's the question?
What I wanted to ask was what kind of problems did they have with this kind of project?
Yeah. Why did you go to Arabs?
We went there, we were invited by a group in Cairo that wanted to make an Arabic version, which means some of our chapters, but then with Arabic commentaries to it. So obviously we're invited because they had some enthusiasm for the project, which is not to say that they didn't have problems with it. They clearly have very big problem with seeing the international community, whether that means the United Nations or other institutions, as legitimate. And hence, they also find it difficult to think of global civil society as something legitimate and something truly global. I think that there was a lot of suspicion in that sense, but very much a willingness to engage in debate. What was even more interesting was the person who invited us was actually an Islamist. So we had clear differences of opinion, but we were discussing them.
We will go to anybody who translates our books. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Andrea, and I'm one of your fellow students here at the LSC of Social Policy. And first of all, I just want to say that...
question.
Meghnad, give me a break.
No. There's only one more minute.
Please, I'll be quick, I promise. One of the questions here that was very fundamental, I thought, was not answered, and that was about state-legislated terrorism and corruption, and I want to hand over the microphone to the man who answered it.
No, that's it. No.
You did not answer my question. My question is, how can we talk about global civil society when there's no international law, when there's no civil society to discuss that thing?
There is a lot of international law.
You're bringing a baroness from House of Lords.
Listen to me.
Basically,
I'm answering your question now. Okay?
Okay. That's right.
Your question was answered before by Leslie Sclair, but I'll answer because there's only 1 minute left, and after that I'm going to declare. The thing is, you're saying, how can there be society when there is violence?
No.
Or when there are all kinds of violence, you think there is no law and so on. Now, my view is that historically, since life began, there has always been violence and there has been society. There has never been a case in which law has worked so well that there has never been violence. Indeed, conflict and struggle, either legal or illegal, is what provides a social dynamic. And therefore, today we have all sorts of international law. After all, the International Criminal Court has been set up, and that is an example of an imperfect but good example of international law. Now, what we are doing here in globalization, there are all sorts of forces of global civil society, of certain nation states, for example, the Scandinavian nation states, all sorts of people are trying to generate a framework of international law within which we can, for example, try genocide. The fact that we can do that, and that's what started in 1945 with the Nuremberg trials, means that we are slowly evolving. Now, in the national territorial context, establishing a rule of law took about 2,000 years. And I don't know why we certainly expect that the international law should be born like Athena in a pure form. And therefore, basically, there is corporate gangsterism, there is global terrorism. At the same time, as Leslie Sclave was saying, there are countervailing forces of class struggle. And basically, this is a dialectical process. Eventually, we will go ahead and go and monitor. As academics, we monitor these things. And sometimes, as citizens, we struggle ourselves. Thank you very much for coming here. And and there is a reception in the Robinson Room. Don't get and drink it all up before the speakers get there.